2020, so help you God. In the last week of July 1926, as the summer heat reached infernal temperatures, the trial of Hale and Ramsey for the murder of Henry Roan began at the red brick courthouse in Guthrie. The stage is set. The curtain rises slowly on the great tragedy of the Osage, the long-awaited federal trial of two old-time cowboys, the Tulsa Tribune reported. The trial of Ernest Burkhart, although it ended in a melodramatic flourish with his confession to the Smith murder conspiracy implicating Hale, was merely a prologue to the life-and-death tragedy that goes on the boards today. White stationed extra guards at the jail after attempts to break out the outlaws who were going to testify against Hale. Later, when Hale was being held on a separate tier from the cell housing Blackie Thompson, he passed him a note through a hole where a radiator pipe went through the ceiling. Blackie admitted to agents that Hale had asked him what he required to not testify against him. Blackie added, "I wrote one note that I would not testify against him if he would get me out." Hale wrote back, promising to arrange his escape in return for one more thing, that Blackie then kidnap Ernest Burkhart and make him disappear before he could testify. "He wanted me to take Ernest Burkhart to old Mexico," Blackie said, adding that Hale didn't want Burkhart killed in this country where he could be found. Given the abundance of evidence against Hale and Ramsey, White believed that the verdict would depend in large part on whether the witnesses and the jury became tainted. At Ernest Burkhart's trial, the first panel of prospective jurors had been dismissed after evidence surfaced that Hale had attempted to bribe them. Now, before selecting a jury, prosecutors probed prospective candidates to ascertain whether anyone had approached them. The judge then asked the 12 chosen jurors to swear that they would render a true verdict according to the law and the evidence, so help you God. There was one question that the judge and the prosecutors and the defense never asked the jurors, but that was central to the proceedings. Would a jury of 12 white men ever punish another white man for killing an American Indian? One skeptical reporter noted, "The attitude of a pioneer cattleman toward the full-blood Indian is fairly well recognized." A prominent member of the Osage tribe put the matter more bluntly, "It is a question in my mind whether this jury is considering a murder case or not. The question for them to decide is whether a white man killing an Osage is murder or merely cruelty to animals." On July 29th, as testimony was set to begin, throngs of spectators arrived early in order to get a seat. The temperature outside was 90 degrees, and it was hard to breathe in the courtroom. John Leahy, the prosecutor, rose to give his opening statement. "Gentlemen of the jury," he said, "William K. Hale is charged with aiding and abetting to the killing of Henry Roan, while John Ramsey is charged with the killing." Leahy outlined the alleged facts of the insurance murder plot in a matter-of-fact voice. One observer noted that the veteran of legal battles does not go in for fireworks or courtroom histrionics, but he makes his points all the stronger for his quiet reserve. Looking on, Hale smiled ever so slightly, while Ramsey leaned back in his chair, fanning himself in the heat, a toothpick between his teeth. On July 30th, the prosecution called Ernest Burkhart to the stand. There was speculation that Burkhart would defect again and return to the fold of his uncle, but this time Burkhart answered the prosecution's questions forthrightly. Burkhart recalled that one time Hale and Henry Grammer had discussed how to eliminate Roan. "The original plan was not for Ramsey to shoot Roan," Burkhart said. "Instead, Hale intended to use one of his other primary methods, a batch of poisoned moonshine." Burkhart's testimony finally made public what the Osage had long known. Members of the tribe had been systematically killed with intentionally contaminated alcohol. "In the case of Roan," Burkhart said, "Hale ultimately decided to have him shot. But Hale was furious when he later learned that Ramsey had not, as instructed, fired the bullet into the front of Roan's head and left the gun at the scene. Hale said to me, 'If John Ramsey had done it the way I told him to, nobody would have known but that Roan had attempted suicide,'" Burkhart recalled. On August 7th, the prosecution rested, and the defense soon summoned Hale to the stand. Addressing the jurors as "gentlemen," he insisted. I never devised a scheme to have Roan killed. I also never desired his death. Although Hale had made a compelling witness, White was confident the government had proven its case. In addition to Burkhart's testimony, White had testified to Ramsey's confession, and witnesses had described Hale's fraudulent acquisition of the insurance policy. The prosecutor Roy St. Louis called Hale the ruthless freebooter of death. Another prosecutor said, the richest tribe of Indians on the globe has become the illegitimate prey of white men. The Indian is going. A great principle is involved in this case. People of the United States are following us through the press. The time has now come for you gentlemen to do your part. On August 20th, a Friday, the jury started its deliberations. Hours went by. The next day, the deadlock continued. The Tulsa Tribune said that though the government's case was strong, bets around Guthrie were 5-1 for a hung jury. After 5 days of deliberations, the judge called the parties into the courtroom. He asked the jurors, "Is there any possibility of an agreement on a verdict?" The foreman rose and said, "There is none." The judge asked if the government had any remarks, and St. Louis stood. His face was red, his voice trembling. "There are some good men on the jury and some that are not good," he said. He added that he had been informed that at least one, if not more, members of the panel had been bribed. The judge considered this, then ordered that the jury be dismissed and the defendants held for further trial. White was stunned. More than a year of his work, more than 3 years of the Bureau's work, had reached an impasse. The jury was also hung when Brian Burkhart was tried for the murder of Anna Brown. It seemed impossible to find 12 white men who would convict one of their own for murdering American Indians. The Osage were outraged, and there were murmurings about taking justice into their own hands. White suddenly had to deploy agents to protect Hale, this man whom he so desperately wanted to bring to justice. The government, meanwhile, began preparing to retry Hale and Ramsey for the murder of Roan. As part of this effort, White was asked by the Justice Department to investigate corruption during the first Hale trial. He soon uncovered that there had been a conspiracy to obstruct justice, including bribes and perjury. According to one witness, the defense attorney Jim Springer had offered him money to lie on the stand, and when he refused, Springer aimed what appeared to be a gun in his pocket at him and said, "I will kill you." In early October, a grand jury recommended filing charges against Springer and several witnesses for what it called flagrant attempts to obstruct justice. The grand jury issued a statement, "Such practices should not be endured, otherwise our courts will be a mockery and justice defeated." Several witnesses were indicted and convicted, but prosecutors decided not to charge Springer because he would demand delaying the second trial of Hale and Ramsey until his own case was resolved. Before the retrial of Hale and Ramsey for the murder of Roan began in late October, a Justice Department official advised St. Louis, the prosecutor, that this whole defense is a tissue of lies, and it is up to us to get at the facts. He added, "There will be no one to blame except ourselves if they succeed in fixing this jury." White's men were assigned to safeguard the jury. The prosecution presented essentially the same case, though in more streamlined form. To the surprise of the courtroom, Molly was briefly summoned to the stand by Hale's attorney, Freeling. "Will you state your name?" he asked her.
"Molly Burkhart."
"Are you the present wife of Ernest Burkhart?"
"Yes, sir."
He then exposed the secret that she'd long kept from Ernest, asking, "Was Henry Roan your husband at one time?"
"Yes, sir," she said.
The prosecution protested that the question was immaterial, and the judge agreed. Indeed, there seemed to be no point to the line of questioning other than to inflict more suffering upon her. After she identified a photograph of Roan, she stepped down from the stand and returned to the gallery. When Ernest Burkhart was on the stand, the prosecutor Leahy questioned him about his marriage to Molly. "Your wife is an Osage Indian?" Leahy asked him.
"She is," Ernest replied.
At an earlier proceeding, he was asked what his profession was, and he said, "I don't work.
I married an Osage. One of Hale's lawyers now asked Ernest if he'd pleaded guilty to murdering his wife's sister by blowing up her house while she was inside.
That is right, he said.
Hoping to place the blame for the killings on Ernest, Hale's lawyer recited the names of Molly's murdered family members, one after the other.
Has your wife now any surviving relatives outside of the two children she has by you?
She has not. There was a hush in the courtroom as Molly looked on. Her gaze could no longer be avoided. After only 8 days of testimony, both parties rested. One of the prosecutors said in his closing statement, "The time now has come for you men to stand for law and order and decency. Time to uncrown this king. You should say by your verdict, as courageous men, decent men, that they shall hang by the neck until they are dead."
The judge advised the jury members that they must set aside sympathies or prejudices for either side. He warned, "There never has been a country on this earth that has fallen except when that point was reached, where the citizens would say, we cannot get justice in our courts."
On the evening of October 28th, the jury began deliberating. By the next morning, word spread that the jurors had reached a decision, and the courtroom filled with the familiar participants. The judge asked the foreman if indeed the jury had reached a verdict.
"Yes, sir," he replied, and handed him a sheet of paper.
The judge looked at it for a moment, then passed it on to the clerk. The courtroom was so quiet that the ticking of a clock on the wall could be heard. A reporter later observed, "Hale's face expressed a guarded eagerness. Ramsey's was a mask." Standing in front of the still room, the clerk read out that the jury found John Ramsey and William K. Hale guilty of first-degree murder. Hale and Ramsey appeared shocked. The judge said to them,
"A jury has found you guilty of the murder of an Osage Indian, Mr. Hale and Mr. Ramsey, and it becomes my duty to pass sentence. Under the law, the jury may find you guilty, and that carries the death penalty in a first-degree murder case. But this jury has qualified it with life imprisonment."
The jurors were willing to punish the men for killing an American Indian, but they would not hang them for it. The judge told Hale and Ramsey,
"Stand before the bench."
Hale rose quickly, Ramsey hesitantly. The judge declared that he was sentencing them to the penitentiary for the period of your natural lives. He then asked, "Have you anything to say, Mr. Hale?"
Hale stared straight ahead, vacantly.
"No, sir," he said.
"And you, Mr. Ramsey?"
Ramsey simply shook his head. Reporters rushed out of the courtroom to file their stories, proclaiming, as the New York Times put it, "King of Osage Hills, guilty of murder." The attorney Leahy would hail the outcome as one of the greatest indications of law and justice that has been realized in the country. Molly welcomed the verdict, but as White knew, there were some things that no successful investigation, no system of justice, could restore. A year later, when Anna Brown's murder was prosecuted, Molly attended the trial. By then, Morrison had recanted his confession, shifting his allegiance yet again in the hope of securing compensation from Hale. Authorities had seized a note that he had sent to Hale in prison, in which he had promised to burn down the authorities if I ever get the chance. Prosecutors gave Brian Burkhardt immunity, believing that it was necessary to obtain Morrison's conviction. During the trial, Molly listened again to the gruesome details of how Brian, her brother-in-law, had gotten her sister drunk and then propped up her body while Morrison shot her in the back of the head, or as Brian put it, watered her. Brian recalled that a week after the shooting, he had returned to the scene of the crime with Molly and her family to identify Anna's rotting corpse. The memory had lingered with Molly, but only now could she fully comprehend the scene. Brian was standing near her, staring down at his victim while feigning grief.
"Did you go out to see this body?" an attorney asked Brian.
"That is what we all went for," he said.
The shocked attorney asked him,
You knew Anna Brown's dead body was out there, didn't you?
Yes, sir.
Morrison had been among the onlookers. Ernest had been there, too, comforting Molly, even though he had known that Anna's two killers were standing only a few feet away from them. Similarly, Ernest had known from the moment Rita and Bill Smith's house exploded who was responsible. He had known the truth when, later that evening, he had crept into bed with Molly. And he had known the whole time she had been desperately searching for the killers. By the time Morrison was convicted of Anna's murder, Molly could no longer look at Ernest. She soon divorced him, and whenever her husband's name was mentioned, she recoiled in horror. For Hoover, the Osage murder investigation became a showcase for the modern bureau. As he had hoped, the case demonstrated to many around the country the need for a national, more professional, scientifically skilled force. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch wrote of the murders, "Sheriffs investigated and did nothing. State's attorneys investigated and did nothing. The Attorney General investigated and did nothing. It was only when the government sent Department of Justice agents into the Osage country that law became a thing of majesty." Hoover was careful not to disclose the Bureau's earlier bungling. He did not reveal that Blackie Thompson had escaped under the Bureau's watch and killed a policeman, or that because of so many false starts in the probe, other murders had occurred. Instead, Hoover created a pristine origin story, a founding mythology in which the Bureau, under his direction, had emerged from lawlessness and overcome the last wild American frontier. Recognizing that the new modes of public relations could expand his bureaucratic power and instill a cult of personality, Hoover asked White to send him information that he could share with the press. There is, of course, as you can appreciate, a difference between legal aspects and human interest aspects, and what the representatives of the press would have an interest in would be the human interest aspect, so I would like to have you emphasize this angle. Hoover fed the story to sympathetic reporters, so-called friends of the Bureau. One article about the case, which was syndicated by William Randolph Hearst's company, blared, "Never told before how the government, with the most gigantic fingerprint system on earth, fights crime with unheard-of science refinements, revealing how clever sleuths ended a reign of murder and terror in the lonely hills of the Osage Indian country, and then rounded up the nation's most desperate gang." In 1932, the Bureau began working with the radio program, The Lucky Strike Hour, to dramatize its cases. One of the first episodes was based on the murders of the Osage. At Hoover's request, Agent Berger had even written up fictional scenes which were shared with the program's producers. In one of these scenes, Ramsey shows Ernest Burkhart the gun he plans to use to kill Roan, saying, "Look at her. Ain't she a dandy?" The broadcasted radio program concluded, "So another story ends, and the moral is identical with that set forth in all the others of this series. The criminal was no match for the federal agent of Washington in a battle of wits." The Hoover privately commended White and his men for capturing Hale and his gang and gave the agents a slight pay increase, a small way at least to recognize their efficiency in application to duty. He never mentioned them by name as he promoted the case. They did not quite fit the profile of college-educated recruits that became part of Hoover's mythology. Plus, Hoover never wanted his men to overshadow him. The Osage Tribal Council was the only governing body to publicly single out and praise White and his team, including the undercover operatives. In a resolution which cited each of them by name, the council said, "We express our sincere gratitude for the splendid work done in the matter of investigating and bringing to justice the parties charged." The Osage, meanwhile, had taken their own steps to protect themselves against future plots, persuading Congress to pass a new law. It barred anyone who was not at least half Osage from inheriting head rights from a member of the tribe. Soon after Hale and Ramsey were convicted, White faced a momentous decision. The U.S. Assistant Attorney General, who oversaw the federal prison system, had asked White if he would take over as warden of Leavenworth Prison in Kansas. The oldest federal penitentiary, it was then considered one of the country's most dreaded places to be incarcerated. There had been allegations of corruption at the prison, and the assistant attorney general had told Hoover that White was ideal for the job. "I hate to give up the chances of getting a warden that I think will be as good as Mr. White." Hoover did not want White to leave the Bureau. He told the assistant attorney general that it would be a tremendous loss. Still, Hoover said, "I feel that I would be unfair to White if I should oppose his promotion. I have, as you know, the highest regard for him, personally and officially." After some torment, White decided to leave the Bureau. The job offered him greater pay and meant that he would no longer need to uproot his wife and young boys. It also offered him a chance to preside over a prison, just as his father had, although on a far larger scale. On November 17, 1926, when White was still settling into the new job, two new inmates were convoyed up the prison's horseshoe driveway by U.S. Marshals. The inmates took in their grim destination. Leavenworth was a 366,000-square-foot fortress, which, as a prisoner once described, rose out of the surrounding cornfields like a giant mausoleum adrift in a great sea of nothingness. As the two inmates approached the entryway in shackles, White walked toward them. Their faces were pale from a lack of sunlight, but White recognized them, Hale and Ramsey. "Why, hello, Tom," Hale said to White.
"Hello, Bill," White answered.
Ramsey said to White, "Howdy." White shook hands with both inmates, who were then led away to their cells.